Judy. Well, we come, as Scott has told us, to the end of Nehemiah, and we're looking at that, just that last chapter. When you've heard the first bit of it, I'll look at a bit more. And I wonder, when we come to this finish, how do you like stories to finish when you're reading or hearing? Do you like them to have a happy ending? But then, what if a happy ending doesn't ring true? If you're reading fiction, a satisfying ending needs to fit in with what has gone before. And in non-fiction, the writer needs to tell the truth. So what about the ending of Nehemiah? It depends how you look at it. It can be viewed as a record of Nehemiah's faithfulness, and that's where the reading finished up today. And so you could say it's a happy ending about a faithful man. But Nehemiah's faithfulness, as we've seen in the bit that's read so far, is inextricably linked with the unfaithfulness of numerous other people. So it could also be considered an unhappy ending, though a truthful one. Now, it was tempting as I looked at this to focus on the positive side of the ending, on Nehemiah's faithfulness. And in fact, the first time I ever preached on this chapter, a long while ago now, I did that. But over time I thought, well, that's not being faithful. We need to try and take in the whole of what we're looking at in Scripture as far as we can. So I decided that I would try to emphasise both sides, both the happy and the unhappy, both faithfulness and unfaithfulness. So this is how I'm going to work through Nehemiah 13 this morning, before suggesting that a third perspective needs to be considered. So first of all, the part that's been read, or all but one verse of it, I want to look at unfaithfulness in the temple. The full title for this section should perhaps be Unfaithfulness in the Temple and Nehemiah's Response, the faithfulness as well as the unfaithfulness. But as a title, it'd be a bit long. Chronologically, this incident begins with the absence of Nehemiah when he goes back to Artaxerxes the emperor for a time, although we don't hear that until verse 6. The unfaithfulness begins with the actions of Eliashib while Nehemiah is absent. He is the priest who is given responsibility for supervising the use of the storerooms in the temple. He was required to make sure that they were used in a way which honoured God and which contributed to the right use of the temple. But that is not what he did. Instead, he handed temple space over to Tobiah. And this was wrong for a number of reasons. First, as Nehemiah's account implies, it involved making temple storerooms unavailable for their rightful purpose by handing them over for the private use of an individual. In addition to this, there's the identity of that individual. Tobiah, we're reminded, is an Ammonite, and is stated in Deuteronomy that no Ammonite or Moabite is to be accepted into the assembly of God's people because of the hostility of these nations to the Israelites when they came into the Promised Land. Now, we need to be a bit careful with this and read it in the light of other scripture. It was not an unconditional ban on every individual. That's particularly made clear when we read the book of Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite, but she's accepted and honoured when she sincerely becomes a worshipper of the God of her mother-in-law Naomi, a worshipper of the God of Israel. This ban was a ban on those who hung on to the pagan religion of their ancestors and hung on, more than that, to the hostility of their ancestors to God's people. And that brings us back again to Tobiah. He's already shown himself in Nehemiah's narrative to be hostile to God's people and God's purposes. He's one of the main opponents of the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. And it's for all these reasons that Nehemiah reacts so strongly when he does return to Jerusalem. Verses 7b to 9. I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done. I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the rooms. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God, with the grain offerings and the incense. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't read these words without being reminded of Jesus' reaction to the misuse of the temple. Like Jesus, Nehemiah is zealous for the right use of God's house, and he goes on to deal with the important consequence of what Eliashib did. Since the storerooms were not used to store supplies for the priests and Levites, these men had left Jerusalem and gone back to their fields, abandoning their service in the temple. So Nehemiah restores these rooms to their proper use and places four good men in charge of making sure that the priests and Levites are cared for and God's work is done in the temple. But there is more unfaithfulness and another strong response from Nehemiah. If we read on to verses 15 through to 22, I'm just going to read part of that. In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys, together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore I warned them against selling food on that day. And Nehemiah goes on in verses I'm not going to read to describe at some length the ways in which the Jews failed to keep the Sabbath and his forceful condemnation of this. We need to understand that observance of the Sabbath was one of the primary markers of the Old Covenant, one way in which God's Old Covenant people declared that they belonged to the only true God who had called the people of Israel to be his people. To treat the Sabbath with contempt was to treat God with contempt. The next few verses record measures which Nehemiah took to ensure that they didn't treat the Sabbath with contempt. But what should we do? We are not old covenant people. We are new covenant people. But we are called to be faithful within the way God has called us. Part of that is gathering for worship on a Sunday, which we're doing today. It reminds us too that that is the day of the resurrection. But the great thing that New Covenant people celebrate that wasn't yet available or known by Old Covenant people. And indeed, we are called to be good followers of Jesus Christ on every day of the week, not just on Sundays. However, there's one more story of unfaithfulness to be considered, and one more story of how Nehemiah responded. This is about unfaithfulness in marriage, verses 23 to 28. Now, Nehemiah describes this third form of unfaithfulness in just a few words, picking up at 23. Moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. So we need to ask what's wrong this time. It might help to think of the book of Ruth again in order to see what is not wrong. In that book, Boaz is honoured for marrying Ruth the Moabite. And both Ruth and Boaz are honoured as ancestors of King David. And of course, we know, through King David, of Jesus himself. So there's nothing wrong with marrying a foreigner who has sincerely come to faith in the one true God, even under the Old Covenant. But that's not what has happened here. It is significant that many of the children have not learned Hebrew. This means they're not able to learn to read the scriptures. They didn't have the multiple translations that we have these days. And when the scriptures are read aloud, they may be unable to understand what is being said. And it's significant that Nehemiah goes on to compare their actions with those of King Solomon, who married many foreign wives. 1 Kings records that far from bringing his wives to faith in the God of Israel, Solomon joined them in worshipping false gods, apparently thinking he could worship these gods as well as the one true God. And clearly this is what was happening in Nehemiah's day as well. And this is why Nehemiah reacted so strongly. Part of his reaction is recorded in verses 25 to 27. I rebuked them and called curses down on them. I beat some of them and pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, you are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourselves. Was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you too are doing this and are being unfaithful to God by marrying foreign women? Now, in case you're not sure, I don't think we should endorse Nehemiah's physical and verbal violence, but we should respect his zeal for faithfulness to God. As Christians, we should avoid anything which may draw us away from Jesus. Now, the question of foreign wives doesn't arise, or foreign husbands for that matter, because in the new covenant, all nations are called to follow Jesus. But we can be held back from serving Jesus faithfully. And that includes by being married to someone or closely involved with someone who is opposed to following Jesus. We need to be faithful to Jesus in all things. But I've not considered a few verses that stand out amongst the ones that I've been looking at. And these verses contain that third perspective which I mentioned earlier. All of them, as we go through at various points, record Nehemiah's prayers. We heard one read out, 13:14, and there are others later. And each of the sections which we've looked at ends in the same way, with one or two prayers. So I'm going to look at these prayers. First of all, 13:14 again. Remember me for this, my God, and do not blot out what I've so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. The second section concerning the Sabbath ends like this, 13:22b. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. And the third section concerning intermarriage ends like this, verses 30-31. I purified the priests and the Levites of everything foreign and assigned them duties, each to his own task. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Remember me with favour, my God. Now, these are just a few verses within quite a long chapter, but they are important verses, verses of prayer, and they should guide our reading of the whole chapter. Nehemiah's account is written for people to read, but they are God's people, and his account is to be read and reflected upon in God's presence. We are reminded that it's what God remembers about us which matters most, more than what other people remember about us. But we have another slightly difficult element in this. What about the character of Nehemiah's prayers concerning himself? Some have seen a problem here, and I must say that that's occurred to me, particularly when I first read the chapter. Does Nehemiah rely on his own good works to earn himself acceptance with God? This would be an understandable interpretation of his prayers, but I don't think it's a correct one. First, they are prayers. They're not demands for God's favour that's been earned, but requests to God to show favour. And I believe the wording of the second prayer guides our interpretation of all three prayers. Going back to 22b. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. So Nehemiah doesn't ask God to remember his faithful actions by themselves, but he nonetheless asks not for justice according to his own actions, but mercy according to God's great love. And the word translated love here is a very significant word in the Old Testament. It is used over and over to describe the character of God. In the AV, it was almost always translated as mercy, while more modern translators have usually used expressions involving love, such as steadfast love and loyal love and covenant love. It is also closely akin to the word grace in the English New Testament. And this word reminds us that none of us can earn God's favour. No matter how faithfully we act, and none of us act faithfully all the time, but even if we did, it wouldn't measure up to God's faithfulness. So we need God's grace. We're dependent on God's grace, what he's done for us in Jesus, his undeserved favour, which springs not from our righteousness, our faithfulness, but from his love. So the calling to us in this chapter is to be people who rely on God's grace, relying not on what we can do, but what Jesus has done for our acceptance by God. And yet, let us also be people who endeavour to be faithful followers of Jesus. Surely, if we really consider what Jesus has done for us, we will want to be faithful. Not because that will earn us a place, we can't do that, but because that will express our holding on to the place that God gives us. And when we fail, when we are not faithful, God's merciful forgiveness is available to us. And yet, if we love Jesus Christ, we must endeavour in our weakness nonetheless to be faithful to our God.